If our soldiers are not overburdened with money, it is not because they have a distaste for riches. If their lives are not unduly long, it is not because they are disinclined to longevity. The general must see to it that temptations to shirk fighting and grow rich are not thrown in the way of his men. On the day they are ordered out to battle, your soldiers may weep, those sitting up bedewing their garments, and those lying down letting the tears run down their cheeks. But let them once be brought to bay, and they will display the courage of a Chuan Chu or Cao Gui. The skillful tactician may be likened to the Shuai Zhan. Now the Shuai Zhan is a snake that is found in the Chang Mountains. Strike at its head, and you will be attacked by its tail. Strike at its tail, and you will be attacked by its head. Strike at its middle, and you will be attacked by head and tail both. Asked if an army can be made to imitate the Shuai Zhan, I should answer, yes. For the men of Wu and the men of Yue are enemies. Yet if they are crossing a river in the same boat and are caught by a storm, they will come to each other's assistance, just as the left hand helps the right. It is not enough to put one's trust in the tethering of horses and the bearing of chariot wheels in the ground. It is not enough to render flight impossible by such mechanical means. You will not succeed unless your men have tenacity and unity of purpose, and above all, a spirit of sympathetic cooperation. This is a lesson which can be learned from the Shuai Zhan. The principle on which to manage an army is to set up one standard of courage that all must reach. How to make the best of both strong and weak is a question involving the proper use of ground. Thus, the skillful general conducts his army just as though he were leading a single man by the hand. It is the business of a general to be quiet and thus ensure secrecy. He must be upright and just, and thus maintain order. He must be able to mystify his officers and men by false reports and appearances, and thus keep them in total ignorance. By altering his arrangements and changing his plans, the leader keeps the enemy without definite knowledge. By shifting his camp and taking circuitous routes, he prevents the enemy from anticipating his purpose. At the critical moment, the leader of an army acts like one who has climbed up a height and then kicks away the ladder behind him. He carries his men deep into hostile territory before he shows his hand. He burns his boats and breaks his cooking pots. Like a shepherd driving a flock of sheep, he drives his men this way and that, and none knows whither he is going. It is the business of a general to muster his host and bring it into danger. The different measures suited to the 9 varieties of ground, the expediency of aggressive or defensive tactics, and the fundamental laws of human nature. These are things that must most certainly be studied. When invading hostile territory, the general principle is that penetrating deeply brings cohesion. Penetrating but a short way means dispersion. When you leave your own country behind and take your army across neighboring territory, you find yourself on critical ground. When there are means of communication on all four sides, the ground is one of intersecting highways. When you penetrate deeply into a country, it is serious ground. When you penetrate but a little way, it is facile ground. When you have the enemy's strongholds on your rear, and narrow passes in front, it is hemmed-in ground. When there is no place of refuge at all, it is desperate ground. Therefore, on dispersive ground, I would inspire my men with unity of purpose. On facile ground, I would see that there is close connection between all parts of my army. On contentious ground, I would hurry up my rear guard. On open ground, I would keep a vigilant eye on my defenses. On ground of intersecting highways, I would consolidate my alliances. On serious ground, I would try to ensure a continuous stream of supplies. On difficult ground, I would keep pushing on along the road. On hemmed-in ground, I would block any way of retreat. On desperate ground, I would proclaim to my soldiers the hopelessness of saving their lives. For it is the soldier's disposition to offer an obstinate resistance when surrounded, to fight hard when he cannot help himself, and to obey promptly when he has fallen into danger. We cannot enter into alliance with neighboring princes until we are acquainted with their designs. We are not fit to lead an army on the march unless we are familiar with the face of the country, its mountains and forests, its pitfalls and precipices, its marshes and swamps. We shall be unable to turn natural advantages to account unless we make use of local guides. To be ignorant of any one of the following principles does not befit a warlike prince. When a warlike prince attacks a powerful state, his generalship shows itself in preventing the concentration of the enemy's forces. He overawes his opponents, and their allies are prevented from joining against him. Hence, he does not strive to ally himself with all and sundry, nor does he foster the power of other states. He carries out his own secret designs, keeping his antagonists in awe. Thus, he is able to capture their cities and overthrow their kingdoms. Bestow rewards without regard to rule. Issue orders without regard to previous arrangements, and you will be able to handle a whole army as though you had to do with but a single man. Confront your soldiers with the deed itself. Never let them know your design. When the outlook is bright, bring it before their eyes, but tell them nothing when the situation is gloomy. Place your army in deadly peril, and it will survive. Plunge it into desperate straits, and it will come through in safety. For it is precisely when a force has fallen into harm's way that it is capable of striking a blow for victory. Success in warfare is gained by carefully accommodating ourselves to the enemy's purpose. By persistently hanging on the enemy's flank, we shall succeed in the long run in killing the commander-in-chief. This is called the ability to accomplish a thing by sheer cunning. On the day that you take up your command, block the frontier passes, destroy all passports and permits, and stop the passage of all emissaries either to or from the enemy's country. Be stern in the council chamber, so that you may control the situation. If the enemy leaves a door open, you must rush in. Forestall your opponent by seizing what he holds dear, and subtly contrive to time his arrival on the ground. Walk in the path defined by rule, and accommodate yourself to the enemy until you can fight a decisive battle. At first, exhibit the coyness of a maiden, so that the enemy will open his door. Afterward, move with the speed of a hare, and it will be too late for the enemy to oppose you.
Chen Hao said, "To be on desperate ground is like sitting in a leaking boat or crouching in a burning house."
Ho Shi told the following anecdote about speed. Li Jing was sent to reduce the rebel Shao Xian, who had set up as emperor at Qingzhou Fu. It was autumn, and the Yangtze being then in flood, Shao Xian never dreamt that his adversary would venture to come down through the gorges, and consequently made no preparations. But Li Jing embarked his army without loss of time, and was just about to start when the other generals implored him to postpone his departure until the river was in a less dangerous state for navigation. Li Jing replied, "To the soldier, overwhelming speed is of paramount importance, and he must never miss opportunities. Now is the time to strike, before Shao Xian even knows that we have got an army together. If we seize the present moment when the river is in flood, we shall appear before his capital with startling suddenness, like the thunder which is heard before you have the time to stop your ears against it. This is the great principle in war. Even if he gets to know of our approach, he will have to levy his soldiers in such a hurry that they will not be fit to oppose us. Thus the full fruits of victory will be ours. All came about as he predicted, and Shao Xian was obliged to surrender, nobly stipulating that his people should be spared and he alone suffer the penalty of death.
Chen told this story of General Wang Jin, who had invaded the Chu state, where a universal draft was instituted to oppose him. Being doubtful of the temper of his troops, Wang Jin declined all invitations to fight and remained strictly on the defensive. In vain did the Chu general try to force a battle. Day after day, Wang Jin kept inside his walls and would not come out, but devoted his whole time and energy to winning the affection and confidence of his men. He took care that they should be well fed, sharing his own meals with them, provided facilities for bathing, and employed every method of judicious indulgence to weld them into a loyal and homogeneous body. After some time had elapsed, he told certain persons to find out how the men were amusing themselves. The answer was that they were competing with one another at lifting weights and broad jumps. When Wang Jin heard that they were engaged in these athletic pursuits, he knew that their spirits had been strung up to the required pitch and that they were now ready for fighting. By this time, the Chu army, after repeating their challenge again and again, had marched away eastward in disgust. Wang Jin immediately broke up his camp and followed them, and in the battle that ensued, they were routed with great slaughter.
Zhao Gong said this of soldiers weeping. This is not because they are afraid, but because all have embraced the firm resolution to do or die.
Yuan Zhu and Zhao Gui were heroes known for personal valor. Yuan Zhu committed an assassination at the cost of his own life, while Zhao Gui, during a delicate treaty negotiation, held a knife against the chest of his opponent until he was promised full restitution of lands.
Du Yu said, "Burn your baggage, throw away your supplies, choke up the wells, destroy your cooking stoves, and make it plain to your men that they cannot survive but must fight to the death."
Mei Yao Chen said, "The only chance of life lies in giving up all hope of it."
Zhang Yu, speaking of being deeply involved in a perilous position, told this story. When Pan Chao arrived at Shanshan, Guang, the king of the country, received him with great politeness and respect. But shortly afterward, his behavior underwent a sudden change, and he became remiss and negligent. Pan Chao spoke about this to his officers. "Have you not noticed," he said, "that Guang's polite attentions are on the wane? This must signify that envoys have come from the northern barbarians, and that consequently he is in a state of indecision, not knowing with which side to throw in his lot." Thereupon he called one of the natives who had been assigned to his service and set a trap for him, saying, "Where are those envoys from the Xiongnu who arrived some days ago?" The man was so taken aback that, between surprise and fear, he presently blurted out the whole truth. Pan Chao, keeping his informant carefully under lock and key, then summoned a gathering of his officers, 36 in all, and began drinking with them. When the wine had mounted into their heads a little, he tried to rouse their spirits still further by addressing them thus: "Gentlemen, here we are in the heart of an isolated region, anxious to achieve riches and honor by some great exploit. Now, it happens that an ambassador from the Xiongnu arrived in this kingdom only a few days ago, and the result is that the respectful courtesy extended toward us by our royal host has disappeared. Should this envoy prevail upon him to seize our party and hand us over to the Xiong Nu, our bones will become food for the wolves of the desert. What are we to do? With one accord, the officers replied, standing as we do in peril of our lives, we will follow our commander through life and death.
Mei Yao Chen constructed this chain of reasoning. In attacking a powerful state, if you can divide her forces, you will have a superiority in strength. If you have a superiority in strength, you will overawe the enemy. If you overawe the enemy, the neighboring states will be frightened. If the neighboring states are frightened, the enemy's allies will be prevented from joining her.
Zhang Yu and Jin Lin said, your arrangements should not be divulged beforehand. There should be no fixity in your rules and arrangements.
Chapter 12. Attack by Fire and Water. Cultivating Resources.
Sun Tzu said, there are five ways of attacking with fire. The first is to burn soldiers in their camp. The second is to burn supplies. The third is to burn baggage trains. The fourth is to burn arsenals and magazines. The fifth is to hurl dropping fire among the enemy. In order to carry out an attack with fire, we must have means available. The material for raising fire should always be kept in readiness. There is a proper season for making attacks with fire, and special days for starting a conflagration. The proper season is when the weather is very dry. The special days are those when the moon is in the constellations of the sieve, the wall, the wing, or the crossbar. For these four are all days of rising wind. In attacking with fire, one should be prepared to meet five possible developments. 1. When fire breaks out inside the enemy's camp, respond at once with an attack from without. 2. If there is an outbreak of fire but the enemy's soldiers remain quiet, bide your time and do not attack. 3. When the force of the flames has reached its height, follow it up with an attack, if that is practicable. If not, stay where you are. 4. If it is possible to make an assault with fire from without, do not wait for it to break out within, but deliver your attack at a favorable moment. 5. When you start a fire, be to the windward of it. Do not attack from the leeward. A wind that rises in the daytime lasts long, but a night breeze soon falls. In every army, the five developments connected with fire must be known, the movements of the stars calculated, and a watch kept for the proper days. Hence, those who use fire as an aid to the attack show intelligence. Those who use water as an aid to the attack gain an accession of strength. By means of water, an enemy may be intercepted, but not robbed of all his belongings. Unhappy is the fate of one who tries to win his battles and succeed in his attacks without cultivating the spirit of enterprise, for the result is waste of time and general stagnation. Hence the saying, the enlightened ruler lays his plans well ahead. The good general cultivates his resources. Move not unless you see an advantage. Use not your troops unless there is something to be gained. Fight not unless the position is critical. No ruler should put troops into the field merely to satisfy his own rage. No general should fight a battle simply out of anger. Anger may in time change to gladness. Vexation may be succeeded by content. But a kingdom that has once been destroyed can never come again into being, nor can the dead ever be brought back to life. Hence, the enlightened ruler is heedful, and the good general full of caution. This is the way to keep a country at peace and an army intact.
Du Mu illustrated the principle of attack by fire with these anecdotes. The famous Li Ling once baffled the leader of the Xiong Nu when the latter, taking advantage of a favorable wind, tried to set fire to the Chinese general's camp only to find that every scrap of combustible vegetation in the neighborhood had already been burned down. On the other hand, Po Tsai, a general of the Yellow Turban rebels, was badly defeated through his neglect of this simple precaution. At the head of a large army, he was besieging a very small garrison held by Wang Fu Sung, who called his officers together and said, "In war, there are various indirect methods of attack, and numbers do not count for everything. Now the rebels have pitched their camp in the midst of thick grass, which will easily burn when the wind blows. If we set fire to it at night, they will be thrown into a panic, and we can make a sortie and attack them on all sides at once." That evening a strong breeze sprang up, so Wang Fu Sung instructed his soldiers to bind reeds together into torches and mount guard on the city walls, after which he sent out a band of daring men who stealthily made their way through the lines and started the fire with loud shouts and yells. Simultaneously, a glare of light shot up from the city walls, and Wang Fu Sung, sounding his drums, led a rapid charge which threw the rebels into confusion and put them to headlong flight.
Du Mu said, "If the wind is in the east, begin burning to the east of the enemy and follow up the attack yourself from that side. If you start a fire on the east side and then attack from the west, you will suffer in the same way as your enemy."
Regarding the enlightened ruler, Du Mu said, "The warlike prince controls his soldiers by his authority, knits them together by good faith, and keeps them loyal by means of rewards. If faith decays, there will be disruption. If rewards are deficient, commands will not be respected."
Chapter 13, The Use of Spies. Divine Manipulation of the Threads.
Sun Tzu said, "Raising a host of 100,000 men and marching them great distances entails heavy loss on the people and a drain on the resources of the state. The daily expenditure will amount to 1,000 ounces of silver. There will be commotion at home and abroad, and men will drop down exhausted on the highways. As many as 700,000 families will be impeded in their labor. Hostile armies may face each other for years, striving for the victory that is decided in a single day. This being so, to remain in ignorance of the enemy's condition, simply because one grudges the outlay of 100 ounces of silver in honors and fees, is the height of inhumanity. One who acts thus is no leader of men, no help to his sovereign, and no master of victory. What enables the wise sovereign and the good general to strike and conquer, achieving things beyond the reach of ordinary men, is foreknowledge. Now this foreknowledge cannot be elicited from spirits. It cannot be obtained inductively from experience, nor by any deductive calculation. Knowledge of the enemy's dispositions can only be obtained from other men. Hence, the use of spies, of whom there are 5 classes, local spies, internal spies, converted spies, doomed spies, surviving spies. When these 5 kinds of spies are all at work, none can discover the secret system. This is called the divine manipulation of the threads. It is the sovereign's most precious faculty. Having local spies means employing the services of the inhabitants of a district. Having internal spies means making use of officials of the enemy. Having converted spies means getting hold of the enemy's spies and using them for our own purposes. Having doomed spies means doing certain things openly for purposes of deception and allowing our own spies to know of them and report them to the enemy. Surviving spies, finally, are those who bring back news from the enemy's camp. Hence it follows that there must be no more intimate relations in the whole army than those maintained with spies. no one should be more liberally rewarded, and nowhere else should greater secrecy be preserved. Spies cannot be usefully employed without a certain intuitive sagacity. Spies cannot be properly managed without benevolence and directness. Without subtle ingenuity of mind, one cannot make certain of the truth of their reports. Be subtle. Be subtle. And use your spies for every kind of business. If a secret piece of news is divulged by a spy before the time is ripe, he must be put to death together with the person to whom the secret was told. Whether the object be to crush an army, to storm a city, or to assassinate an individual, it is always necessary to begin by finding out the names of the attendants, the aides-de-camp, the doorkeepers, and sentries of the general in command. Our spies must be commissioned to ascertain these. The enemy's spies who have come to spy on us must be sought out, tempted with bribes, led away, and comfortably housed. Thus, they will become converted spies and available for our service. It is through the information brought by the converted spy that we are able to acquire and employ local and internal spies. It is owing to his information again that we can cause the doomed spy to carry false tidings to the enemy. Lastly, it is by his information that the surviving spy can be used on appointed occasions. The end and aim of spying in all its five varieties is knowledge of the enemy. And this knowledge can only be derived in the first instance from the converted spy. Hence, it is essential that the converted spy be treated with the utmost liberality. Of old, the rise of the Yin dynasty was due to Yi Zhi, who had served under Xia. Likewise, the rise of the Zhou dynasty was due to Lu Ya, who had served under the Yin. Hence, it is only the enlightened ruler and the wise general who will use the highest intelligence of the army for purposes of spying, and thereby they achieve great results. Spies are a most important element in war, because upon them depends an army's ability to move.
Mei Yao Chen said, "Knowledge of the spirit world is to be obtained by divination. Information in natural science may be sought by inductive reasoning. The laws of the universe can be verified by mathematical calculation. But the dispositions of the enemy are ascertainable through spies, and spies alone."
Du Mu said, "In the enemy's country, win people over by kind treatment and use them as spies."
Enumerating those likely to serve as internal spies, he cited worthy men who have been degraded from office, criminals who have undergone punishment, favorite concubines who are greedy for gold, men who are grieved at being in subordinate positions or who have been passed over in the distribution of posts, others who are anxious that their side should be defeated in order that they may have a chance of displaying their ability and talents, fickle turncoats who always want to have a foot in each boat. Officials of these kinds should be secretly approached and bound to one's interests by means of rich presents. In this way, you will be able to find out the state of affairs in the enemy's country, ascertain the plans that are being formed against you, and, moreover, disturb the harmony and create a breach between the sovereign and his ministers. But there is a necessity for extreme caution in dealing with internal spies."
Of converted spies, Zhang Yu said, "We must tempt the converted spy into our service, because it is he who knows which of the local inhabitants are greedy of gain, and which of the officials are open to corruption."
Of converted spies, Du Yu said, "By means of heavy bribes and liberal promises, detach them from the enemy's service and induce them to carry back false information, as well as to spy in turn on their own countrymen.
And of doomed spies, we do things calculated to deceive our own spies, who must be led to believe that they have been unwittingly disclosed. Then, when these spies are captured in the enemy's lines, they will make an entirely false report, and the enemy will take measures accordingly, only to find that we do something quite different. The spies will thereupon be put to death.
Dumu further spoke of surviving spies. This is the ordinary class of spies who should form a regular part of the army. Your surviving spy must be a man of keen intellect, though an outward appearance a fool. He must be of shabby exterior, but with a will of iron. He must be active, robust, and endowed with physical strength and courage. He must be thoroughly accustomed to all sorts of dirty work, able to endure hunger and cold, shame and ignominy.
Of the sagacity required by one who uses spies, Dumu said, before using spies, we must assure ourselves as to their integrity of character and the extent of their experience and skill. A brazen face and a crafty disposition are more dangerous than mountains or rivers. It takes a man of genius to penetrate such.
Jia Lin said, an army without spies is like a man without ears or eyes. Fighting South of the Castle, an anonymous Chinese poem, circa 124 BCE.
They fought south of the castle. They died north of the wall. They died in the moors and were not buried. Their flesh was the food of crows.
Tell the crows we are not afraid. We have died in the moors and cannot be buried. Crows, how can our bodies escape you?
The waters flowed deep, and the rushes in the pool were dark. The riders fought and were slain. Their horses wandered neighing. By the bridge there was a house. Was it south? Was it north? The harvest was never gathered.
How can we give you your offerings? You served your prince faithfully, though all in vain. I think of you, faithful soldiers. Your service shall not be forgotten. For in the morning you went out to battle, and at night you did not return.
Copyright 1996, Dove Audio Incorporated. If you would like to receive a Dove Audio or Dove Kids